Okay, thanks, Kim, and thanks, Kim, for helping organize this session. It's a pleasure to be here today. So I'm going to, Rachel and I are going to kind of set the stage for this session and give a little bit of a background around the issue of resiliency, talk about some methods of building community resilience, and talk a little bit about how communities can link resilience to ongoing efforts to address climate change threats, and then some conclusions. So kind of just starting off with an operating definition of community resilience. So, you know, our little panel talked and looked at some of the literature, and we seem to be pretty happy with this definition. But, you know, resilience is really a much larger field than, whoa, am I waterfalling now? It's a much larger field than just climate change. It's kind of spans discipline, so it's actually a huge body of literature. So, you know, we're trying to think about, this is a more of a generic definition, so communities anticipating and prepare for risks, they want to be able to limit, how can they limit the effects of these risks, and then this adaptation piece is kind of key. How can communities adapt to changing conditions? So there's actually, when we're thinking about vulnerability, so if you look at this flow chart and you look at the bottom, you say, well, how are communities vulnerable? And this is kind of the standard IPCC framework, the IPCC Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, when they're talking about vulnerability, it's a sum of three components. First of all, the exposure. In this case, it could be a huge storm bearing down on the East Coast, if you can imagine. And then the population sensitivity is the second part of that. There's people live in those sewers that are being flooded in New York City. Now, if there's a lot of people in there, in those sewers, then that would not be a good population characteristic. And adaptive capacity then, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about adaptive capacity. We think of that as two parts. We think of it as a community resilience part and an institutional resilience part. Community, and well, I'll define that a little bit more. And so those three pieces in, the exposure, the population characteristics or sensitivity, and adaptive capacity, you need to think about all three of those when you're thinking of population vulnerability. Now, we were doing some more work thinking about vulnerability and say, you know, there's one other piece, and this is stuff that Rachel and her colleagues, Manuel Pastor and Jim Sand and others, have been thinking about cumulative impacts. Now, how does a population that already is suffering through cumulative impacts, does that fit into the picture also? And what, you know, one good example I can think of that when thinking about heat, some of the work I've done with heat, and Jan, maybe you saw this too when you were there in Chicago, but one of the things that we thought about is in lower income neighborhoods, a lot of people put, you know, even though it's hot at night, do they open their windows at night in a low-income neighborhood that's plagued with a lot of violence? No. They already have the violence stressor. There's, you know, bars on their windows or whatever, but people would be, say, too afraid to open their windows at night. So that's kind of an example of how that accentuates the exposure threat from a heat wave with other cumulative impacts that might be in a society. Here's, a standard definition then of the adaptive capacity piece. So the ability of the population to adapt to the exposure, take advantage of whatever opportunities are available to enhance resilience or decrease the impact of the exposures. And then also the aftermath part, the coping part, is important also. So I told you I was going to define then these two pieces of adaptive capacity. So there's the community resilience part. So when we think about this, I already mentioned the crime part. It could be, this list is just a sample, but you could think of a lot of other things. You could think of even social capital issues like, the number of people voting in a community. I know people have looked at some of those type of community attributes, but you can really expand that. But it could be income inequality or quality issues, food security. I'm sure you can think of a larger number of examples of that. And then the institutional resilience, you're thinking about, you know, what's the emergency response capacity? What is the public health capacity? What's the infrastructure there? What's the, you know, the public transit? When you're thinking about the classic example of a huge exposure, say Hurricane Katrina, it was access to, you know, getting people out of the area. So the people that got out of the area, those were the ones that were able to escape the exposure and have that institutional capacity to help them there. So here's some examples of how to build community resilience. First of all, doing vulnerability assessments. And I have in the back some copies of a vulnerability assessment that we did in California, a population vulnerability assessment for heat. And so you can kind of see the pieces of that back there. Structural metrics of social inequality, and I think Rachel is going to talk a little bit more about that. Developing efficient communication networks and partnerships and leadership development. So this is some work that we have coming out where we started thinking about the climate change vulnerability issue in California. And we did this just in two counties in California, in Los Angeles and Fresno counties. And here's a number of attributes where we were trying to think of the exposure, the population sensitivity, and the adaptive capacity pieces, and try to find some variables, some indicators that could fit into that to define vulnerability. So, for example, you know, central air conditioning, that's going to be, you know, an issue with resilience, as you can imagine. It can be, you can put that in the adaptive capacity piece. Tree canopy, that also is part of how the community might be able to prepare for these climate change public health risks. Impervious surfaces, so those are all the paved surfaces in a community, a marker for the heat island effect, that we've been able to see that urban areas cool off at night at a much slower rate than rural areas. So we want to reduce this percentage of impervious surfaces so we can get these data from different data sources. Public transit routes, which I've mentioned, and then some other population factors which might be of interest, like the percentage of people of elderly living alone, and do they have access to private cars? Again, another key factor on people that were able to get out of the Hurricane Katrina area. And then we had some exposures in there, like data from the California Department of Forestry on wildfire risk areas and FEMA flood risk zones, which unfortunately they haven't been updated for climate change risks. And then the Pacific Institute out here of Oakland, California, who did a really great study on sea rise inundation. So we basically took these data, ranked them by quintiles, and mapped them at the census tract level, and came up with a final vulnerability score. And I'm not going to show you, don't have time to show you a lot of the results, but here's, you know, for example, and also LA County looked a lot more interesting because there's a lot more variability, so I'm not really going to show you much around Fresno. But here's LA County, any of you that know LA County. So looking at this map, the red areas then are the highest risk areas and the darker green, the lower risk areas. So in this case, the red areas mean they had low air conditioning ownership. And let's see if this works all the way from over there. Or I can use a little arrow. Oh, okay. Not really well. So here, can you guys see that? So these are the urban core. These are lower income parts of Los Angeles County, and actually they need air conditioning here. These places along the coast, these would tend to not be so low income, but they're probably not thinking they need that much air conditioning. So that's how we're interpreting that graph. So this is our final vulnerability score. This is kind of interesting because it does show up some of the low-income areas as higher climate vulnerability, but also some of the places along the coast too. And then when we looked, you know, some people said, well, you know, that's no good. You know, your method didn't really identify the vulnerable places. And then when we started looking at the data, it was, well, turns out there's a large number of elderly living alone here. They have poor public transit access. Also, so they're kind of isolated elderly populations. So, you know, when you think about putting together these matrices, you'll have to. It's kind of nice to maybe have the ability to put things in and out as you think You know, what is your target populations? What factors do you think are more important? None of this was weighted. We're hoping to put this like up on the internet so you could like either weight pieces or turn different layers on and off. But this is when you look at the combination of all those factors that you come up with. And this is just kind of a blow up of the Los Angeles area there. And then we decided then to work with Rachel and her colleagues then to put this cumulative impact piece added as another layer on top of this climate change vulnerability. And her and their methodology has three main categories: proximity to hazards and sensitive land uses, health risks and exposure, and social and health vulnerability. It's a combination of, it's 23 factors, isn't it, Rachel? That number kind of sticks in my head. I think there's 23 variables in this, and you can read more about this. So they had let's add cumulative impacts and see how the maps change. So when we add that, I'm going to see if I can go back and forth here. But how can I go up? Page up, maybe? Yeah. So when you see, look at the map here, and then notice that when we put that cumulative impact score, it really moves the risks more into the urban areas. So I thought about this a little bit, and I haven't really talked with Rachel and others, but I think it might show kind of the focus on the urban risks in the cumulative impact scores, and that kind of makes sense. I mean, more urbanized areas might have more of these cumulative impacts, and I think, Rachel, you can talk about this, but I think you're trying to expand this into rural risks and our kind of understanding of this kind of dichotomy between urban and rural, but I think that illustrates that piece. So I think that's all I was going to say, and yeah, why don't you go on?
We have 10 minutes.
Okay. So you've got the tag team here. Two brains make a smart person. Okay, so one of the results from this work is taking this map and trying to come up with some summary statistics about who's bearing the burden, at least in terms of climate change vulnerability metrics. And as Paul's analysis shows here, at least in terms of the LA area that was mapped, African Americans and Latinos reside in census tracts where you see that are in the highest two risk quartiles in terms of combined scores of these climate change vulnerability metrics. And then you also see a relationship between climate vulnerability score and income, where the highest scores are among the lowest income groups within the LA County area. So this can also sort of give you the beauty of this type of approach is that you can map these areas and highlight areas of concern where you might want to target regulatory and public health planning efforts, but you can also get aggregate statistics and get a sense population-wide within a region who appears to be bearing the burden of climate change vulnerability, and this can give you some insight about adaptation strategies as well. So I want to wrap this up by talking about implications for future work and how we want to scale up the analysis and some work that we're doing on this question. So one of the things that we're doing, and Paul alluded to this earlier, is we also believe that social context really matters when we're looking at questions of climate change vulnerability. And what I mean by that is not just about your neighborhood, but about the metro area or the region in which you're living. So here we're looking again at neighborhood characteristics, and this is for several metro areas in California, looking at land cover characteristics by the proportion of people in neighborhoods that are proportion of neighborhood residents who are living in below the poverty line. And so what you can see here is for each metro area, this is Los Angeles, Sacramento, San Diego, and San Francisco. I think I need some new contacts. What you can see is that with increasing levels of poverty, there's increasing impervious surface and decreasing tree canopy, which is the green. And you can see this pattern basically for each metro area within the major metro area within the state of California, although some metro areas are doing better overall than others in terms of heat island risks. This pattern looks at a similar analysis, but looking at the proportion of neighborhood residents who self-identify as a person of color. And so you can see that with an increasing proportion of the neighborhood residents of color, this is the high end, again, this is the high end for each metro area, you see increasing proportion of land cover in the brown as impervious surface and decreasing tree canopy. So getting back to context, we're trying to scale up this analysis nationally, and we want to look at regional context, too, as an important factor for understanding climate vulnerability. This is, again, looking at indicators of heat island risk, looking at the combination of the odds of living in a block group that either does not have continuous tree canopy and that is mostly covered by impervious surface. And in this case, we wanted to look at racial disparities. We were looking at these for over 300 U.S. metro areas in the United States. And we wanted to look at racial disparities, but we also wanted to look at what are the different patterns that we see depending on racial residential segregation of major metro areas. And so what we see here is these are moderately segregated cities, and these are extremely segregated cities. And then each one of these colors represents a racial or ethnic group as identified by the U.S. Census. And so what we see here is that heat island risks increase, or you see wider racial disparities in cities where you see more racial residential segregation. So these are extremely segregated metro areas. Compared to their least segregated counterparts. But the other thing that you see is that heat island risks are worse for everyone overall. So white residents living in extremely segregated areas have higher heat island risks compared to their white counterparts in less segregated cities. So we think that these analyses also have interesting implications because it's not just a question of obviously, you want to deal with heat island risk by dealing with impervious surface and tree canopy, but social policies are probably going to have to play a role in if we're going to really get at underlying causes of racial and socioeconomic disparities in climate vulnerability. So some applications of the work that Paul has showed you and that we have collaborated on in that paper. We're fortunate in the state of California to have, and we're the ninth, well, depending on what day you ask us, we're the ninth largest economy in the world. And we have the Global Warming Solution Act, known as AB 32. So we have some pretty ambitious goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Which is fantastic, and which gives us some opportunities to also address climate vulnerability issues in very severely impacted communities. And most recently, there was some very fantastic legislation that was passed at the end of September, known as SB 535, which is called the Climate and Community Revitalization Acts. Which basically requires California is going to achieve a lot of its greenhouse gas reductions through a cap and trade program where industries are going to eventually be purchasing their right to emit greenhouse gases. That will result in a revenue stream to the state. This recent legislation is going to require that about 25% of that revenue that's generated through our cap and trade program has to be invested in projects that will directly benefit communities that are environmentally burdened and socially vulnerable in terms of climate change impacts and pollution impacts. 10% of those funds are going to have to be invested in those communities directly. So these types of screening approaches that Paul showed you earlier can be a first step towards identifying those places that are ripe for those kinds of investments. And there are a lot of examples now where you have environmental justice communities and communities that are disproportionately impacted by polluting sources and climate change that are trying to address climate change issues on the ground. And we recently released a report this month in collaboration with my colleague Ellen Kirsten, who's in the audience, if you want to talk to her more about this report. But this is a report that if you Google Facing the Climate Gap will come up. And we have provided some interesting case studies where severely impacted communities in the state of California are trying to address issues of climate change vulnerability. And to give examples about where you could possibly scale up these kinds of projects in a broader geographic scope if we really want to take a systemic approach to addressing this question from a public health point of view. So for those of you who are interested in these case studies, this report's available at this website. Again, all you have to do is Google Facing the Climate Gap. And we also have some blog posts that we did in a series in alternate over the course of a week, about 2 weeks ago, if you want to just get the snapshot and not have to read through the whole report. So with that, Ollie will end, and thanks very much.